Please be seated. Thank you. This is a time and place set for oral argument in the matter of administrative appeal of Gary Albrecht et al. Versus Crown Ridge Wind LLC and the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission. Seated with the court today is Circuit Court Judge Bruce Anderson, that we welcome. Chief Justice Jensen having deemed himself disqualified in the matter. Mr. A.J. Swanson will be arguing for the appellants. Ms. Dana Van Palmer appears on behalf of Crown Ridge Wind LLC. And Ms. Amanda Reese on behalf of the Public Utilities Commission. Mr. Swanson, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, I have the privilege of representing the appellants in this case, who are six individuals living in and around the tiny village of Goodwin, South Dakota, in the northeast corner of Dual County. Collectively, they have four homes and are very close to this wind farm. This case, 2916, is, I maintain, joined at the hip with number 29352, which is a matter submitted to this court on briefs in November of 2020. That case involves the Dual County Board of Adjustment and the exercise of the county's zoning power. Collectively, these cases focus on the property rights of landowners who are not in privity with the wind farm applicant. And each case, we say, involves a taking of appellant's property rights, the government's exaction of a de facto easement for the benefit and use of that applicant. In this case, Crown Ridge Wind 2. This is a truly massive project. Involves $400 million investment, 132 wind turbines. They are already built and operating. Spread across seven townships, in three counties, and 61,000 acres of land leased from participants. And also casting the, quote, effects, EFFECTS, end quote, of shadow, flicker, and noise on many thousands of additional acres, including the homes of non-participants. The issues have been, I think, pretty well set forth in the court's handout of this case. They're not exactly the way I have briefed them. But I will say this about that. We have, as appellants, consistently claimed in both of these cases that the applicant wind farm is seeking rights as to our homes and lands in a situation where an easement is truly required. And then by issuing the permit with quantified effects at the homes of appellants, the PUC, or in the case of the other appeal, the County Board of Adjustment, has taken a de facto easement without our consent, the fee owners, and has effectively thwarted also the future use of the nuisance remedy.
Mr. Swanson, in this administrative appeal, as you know, we review what the Public Utilities Commission did under the provisions of Chapter 126. And so Section 126.36, as you know, has a number of bases upon which we can examine the administrative action. What among those bases are implicated here?
Well, I'll be the first one, Justice. It is the action taken by the agency consistent with statutes and constitutional rights. That, in my belief, is our major thrust against.
in your brief, there was a reference to, and perhaps you can clarify it for me, there was a reference, I thought, that I read that suggested this was not yet an inverse condemnation case. This was not yet a takings case, and perhaps not yet a nuisance case, which is part and parcel, as I understand it, of the takings argument. Can you enlighten me as to what your argument is specifically in terms of that argument?
Sure. I think it's a policy matter. I think it's for this court to decide as kind of a final decision impact on what PUC has done. Is what PUC doing with issuing of a facility siting permit under this chapter 49-41B? Which does not mention or imply that it can grant easements or anything of the like. It's to decide whether the facility is going to have minimal adverse effects. The question is that what we want in this state? Does the PUC get to issue what appears to be an immutable permit, which cannot be subsequently challenged by the nuisance remedy, taking in effect an easement upon the homes and lands of the participants and the non-participants, several of whom I represent, who have sought no relief or remedy whatsoever. They're not trying to change the category of their property. Their property is all a perfectly lawful use under the local zoning ordinance. Can that peace and enjoyment, the infliction of an annoyance factor, be taken from them without their consent? In essence, a burden. A servitude can only be granted by those who are in the chain of title of the property. PUC is not among those people. It has taken effect by permitting this. Allowing noise at a certain level, shadow flicker at a certain duration. It has assured my clients of an distress and distress.
So is your...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Is your argument then that the PUC's granting of the permit violated our state constitutional provision, or what was that in violation of in terms of a statutory or constitutional?
I certainly believe it's a violation of my client's constitutional rights arising under the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which should be a reasonable inquiry for this court to make. I think it's also a violation of the state constitutional rights of not taking property without just compensation.
And what legal...
Go ahead, Bruce, I'm sorry.
What legal authority do you rely upon?
Sorry.
That would support that the particular permitting action was in and of itself sufficient to constitute the constitutional violation?
Well, this is a case in which we have consistently maintained for the last 3 years. This case began at the zoning level 3 years ago this month by taking the petition for writ of certiorari. I think the federal law has certainly impacted the strength of our arguments, beginning with the Nick case in Township of Scott decided in 2019, which we've cited in our brief, and more recently the Cedar Point nursery case, decided on June 23 of this year. We think there are interesting parallels to Cedar Point in our case, even though this is not a labor regulation case. But we say by coming in, not getting an easement from the non-participants, getting an easement from everybody else who's going to get shadow flicker and noise, but not the non-participants, that That, in effect, is a taking of the property. It's a violation of the landowner's right to exclude theirs from the use and enjoyment of their land. That's a statutory right which our legislature back in 1877 copied from California, was at issue in the Cedar Point nursery case. I cited that in our reply brief because that case was issued after our main brief was filed.
Is your due process claim preserved? Did you tell the commissioners at the PUC that if you grant this permit, you'll affect a taking?
I think it has been preserved. I've consistently argued that and identified it in the issues both before the PUC, before the circuit court, and in our statement of issues here.
One of the arguments that you have also consistently made, or at least you make it in this appeal, and I thought I had seen elements of it before, is that the PUC was in some way compelled or should have enacted or promulgated rules that would provide definite limits for noise and for shadow flicker. But when I listened to your argument about taking and this deprivation of a property right, I'm unclear as to whether you're suggesting that there's a potentially a level of noise or shadow flicker that can have a finite limit and not transgress the Constitution, or if any degree of shadow flicker or any degree of noise being, as you say, cast upon a non-participating landowner is in and of itself enough, in your view, to make out your due process claim.
I've never argued that, Justice Salter, that any amount of noise or any amount of shadow flicker would transcend our constitutional rights. I'm not the architect of the regulatory scheme that exists here. I didn't write the statutes. I did not advise the commission not to adopt regulations to try and give some flesh to the meaning of what is a minimal adverse effect.
So your argument has to be, forgive me, let me interrupt. So your argument has to be that setting the outlet where the PUC did and setting the decibel limit where it did as conditions of the permit at that 45 level and at that hour limit for shadow flicker, that those limits, you may not know where the limit is, but those are too high. Am I right on that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the basis for adopting those on a case-by-case basis seems rather specious. So as I pointed out in my brief, we have one limit of effects for wind farms that are in the southern part of the state. The experts that testified there came to Dual County to testify there. And we end up, because of their testimony in the prevailing winds case, we've got a noise limit there of the ideal, 40 decibels. We have a shadow flicker limit of 15 hours per year in prevailing winds. We have a daily limit of 30 minutes. In Dual County, we have an entirely different regime of rules and permit conditions that now apply up there.
What is your view for the reason between the different standards in the different projects?
I didn't participate in the prevailing winds case. I wasn't even aware that it was happening at the time that it happened. But the experts were the same. I can't really explain it. The staff of the PUC called their staff witnesses to try and explain it. Their testimony is in the record. I believe it's all a function of what kind of application did the applicant come and present to the PUC. There were several references to how conservative the prevailing winds application was so that they could put a capstone over the effects at those relatively conservative limits, and it didn't affect anything. In the case of Dual County, this wind farm, the PUC staff's own expert, Hessler, and he is a recognized expert. I agree with that. He came and the first thing he said was, this is really an aggressively devised wind farm. On cross-examination, I pressed him a bit at page 507 of the transcript to explain what he meant. And he said, and I'm going to have to paraphrase because I don't have that part committed to memory. He said, when I look at the wind or the noise projections for non-participating homes, I want to maintain 40 dBA as the ideal. In this case, however, there was a great many of non-participant homes who would receive noise greater than 40 dBA and pressing onwards of 45 dBA. Now, that's a logarithmic scale. It does seem like not very much, but it is a tremendous difference to have 40 decibels and 43 or 45.
So I understand decibels. Your argument that it's different. But if it's different in a way that is unconstitutional or violates a statute or a rule, how do we get there? How do we understand your argument of disparity to be one of unwarranted disparity? Or is it just that maybe they're different?
Your time has expired. If you could briefly respond.
Justice Alder, I don't know how to probe that question because I'm not an expert on sound. All I can say is if there's an obvious and significant difference that neither the PUC has sought to justify, never once mentioned the expert's opinion that this is an aggressively devised wind farm, that goes completely unnoticed. Everything we put into the record goes completely unnoticed. They managed to mention our names in the record or in the decision, but that's it. I mean, our positions on this were entirely dismissed and ignored.
Thank you. All right, now, Ms. Van Palmer and Ms. Reese, you'll be dividing your time, is that correct, with Ms. Van Beek Palmer going first at 6 minutes, Ms. Reese going first at 9 minutes. As you may proceed, Ms. Reese.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. Please, the court, counsel. My name is Amanda Reese, and I'm appearing before you today on behalf of the Public Utilities Commission staff. I think I had a statement prepared, and I think, Justice, as you covered many of the issues I deemed to be worthy of discussing, but I think just to highlight a few items, I think it's important to note that the PUC is an administrative body. And as an administrative body, the commission operates within the confines of authority conferred, and it is to implement the statutory provisions within that authority. Specifically, the commission has been tasked by the legislature to review applications for wind energy facility permits. And this would just be permits over 99 megawatts. Upon receipt of such an application, Chapter 4940B provides instructions that the commission make a determination whether the applicant has shown by a preponderance of the evidence that the proposed project meets four specific factors laid out in 4941B22. And when such permits have come to this court, the court has repeatedly held that a commission's determination that a project has met the standard laid out in this statute will only be reversed upon a showing of clear error of judgment and conclusions not supported by fact or abuse of discretion with prejudicial effects. This court has made clear that it is not to substitute its judgment for that of the commission, and the record should be reviewed as a whole. Now, to follow up on one of Justice's questions to counsel regarding whether or not the argument was being made as to whether any impact was a violation, counsel responded that that was not his argument. As I look at that issue, that then puts it into a fact-based determination by the commission that should be granted deference. And when you apply all of this guidance to the record in this case, it's clear the appellant has not shown, nor can it be shown, the commission committed error in granting the permit to Crown Ridge. In fact, the record before the court shows quite the opposite. Upon receipt of the application for a wind energy permit from Crown Ridge 2, the commission processed the docket in accordance with the established law in 4941B. Throughout the proceeding, the commission granted party status to all those who applied, including the six appellants in this case and three other individuals. The commission set a procedural schedule. All parties were permitted to conduct discovery, and an evidentiary hearing was held. All parties were able to present evidence, testimony, and cross-examine each witness. The commission heard from almost 20 witnesses, including multiple experts, a medical doctor, an environmental health expert, acoustical experts, and the commission reviewed thousands of pages of evidence, including scientific studies regarding alleged health impacts of noise and shadow flicker. Eventually, the commission issued a 29-page order granting the permit. This order was complete with 49 permit conditions, conclusions of law, and findings of facts. Each of those identified the specific evidence the commission relied on to determine each applicable standard had been met by a preponderance of the evidence. While significant evidence was presented that Crown Ridge had met the requirements with the conditions imposed by the commission, the appellants failed to introduce evidence directly challenging or conflicting the evidence on the record. The appellants did make vague and unsupported claims that the project would violate their rights. And in response to one of commission questions, appellants indicated, or one of the appellants, it's a very long record, but indicated that no amount of shadow flicker would be acceptable to them. In post-hearing briefs to the commission and oral arguments, or in arguments to the court, appellants failed to provide any real legal basis or authority that recognizes that their claims would constitute a taking. As he noted, or as counsel noted, this is really an issue of first impression before this court. I'm not aware of any court that's recognized the claims that he appears to be making and asking this court to rule on. Now, to wrap up, the commission's order in this case was well reasoned, was supported by substantial evidence, and was without actual. And without an actual showing of abuse or clear error by the appellants, the decision should be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Van Beek-Palmer, you may give your argument on behalf of Crown Ridge Wind.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I don't want to repeat what Ms. Reese has already argued, but one of the questions that I believe Justice Salter asked was regarding what the court can consider. And respectfully, this is an appeal from the commission's order and decision granting a permit. That is all that it is. It is the commission is not a court of general jurisdiction. The commission cannot consider issues such as constitutional arguments. It didn't consider those issues. That being the case, all that this court really is empowered to consider here is whether the commission abused its discretion in granting the permit. As to that question, I really haven't heard the appellants provide any argument or evidence regarding how the commission supposedly abused its discretion. In order to prove that, they need to show a fundamental error, choice outside the range of permissible choices, a decision that is arbitrary and reasonable or unreasonable.
Would they ever have an opportunity then, if not here, to pursue or to press a claim that one of the consequences of the permit is a constitutional taking? Would they ever have that opportunity if they don't have it here?
I believe those arguments have been made to circuit courts, maybe not in this case, but in other cases involving the wind projects. Often we see a writ of cert, writ of mandamus, things of that nature, and those arguments are often made in those cases.
If they were made, let's say, in a subsequent case involving these parties, would the position of Crown Ridge, if not perhaps the commission, B, you can't consider that because the Supreme Court has already blessed the permit if we affirm here?
I think those are different issues. Whether there's been a constitutional taking is certainly a different issue than whether the commission improvidently granted that permit.
So you would not cite, if there was an affirmance here, you would not cite our decision that affirms the issuance of the permit as having preclusive effect in that
I don't think it would have preclusive effect. I'm not saying that that argument couldn't be made depending on the evidence and the other arguments being made, but they're completely different issues. And if the Supreme Court does not address the issue, which I don't believe that it should, then it would not have preclusive effect. But if you like, I can certainly go into why I don't believe that those issues have any merit in any event.
Before you move on, though,
yes.
Whenever they are considering a permit, they have to consider all the arguments that are laid out before them. And in this case, the appellants claim, and I think the record supports that they brought these takings issues up, and the statute, 126.36, says, of course, the court may affirm the decision or remand. The court may reverse or modify the decision if substantial rights of the appellant have been prejudiced. And then, of course, the reason number one is the decision in violation of a constitutional or statutory provision. So is it initially in the permitting process the PUC given some authority to, you know, try and sort these issues out on a legal footing?
I don't know that they are, Your Honor. I think that the commission is given the authority that is granted to them by the legislature, and that authority is expressly set forth in the statutes 49-41B, and addressing a constitutional argument is not among those.
Let's say that there's a situation where there's an obvious constitutional violation if they grant the permit without certain restrictions or easements. Don't they have authority in that under the statute here, the authority to try and resolve that? And if they are violating the Constitution, shouldn't they prohibit the permit?
I think you would have to have probably a different procedure in order for that to happen. But certainly if this court reads the statute that you just read in that way, the commission would have the power to do that. I respectfully read it a different way. I think it's whether the decision impacts the right of the appellants, and that's not the case here. They're not saying the decision impacts their rights. They're saying that the statute impacts their constitutional rights, and I think that's a different argument. But in any event, if you do give them the power to do that, then they can do that. They did not do that in this case. If you read the opinion, it's a 29-page opinion. It's full of citations to the record evidence, and it does cite to Mr. Hessler, and it's fully supported by citation to the statutory authority and to the standard that they do have to apply, which is, does this wind project substantially impair the health, safety, and welfare of the inhabitants? The commission based on all the evidence before them, 14,000 pages of record, 17 witnesses, including every single one of the appellants, expert witness, and the PUC staff and Crown Ridge 2 both produce experts. The appellants did not have any experts to contradict what the other experts were saying. And that is the difference between this case and the prevailing winds case. All of the experts said sound levels at 45 dBA and below do not substantially impair the health, safety, and welfare of its inhabitants. Shadow flicker below 30 hours per year does not substantially impair the health, safety, and welfare. And that is what the court must look at. And we believe that it should affirm in doing so.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Swanson, you may give your final argument.
Mr. Swanson, since you brought up this Prairie Winds project, and you know what the limits were, I want to say there were 40 decibels and 15 hours of flicker as conditions for that permit, would you think or argue that that violates the takings clause or not?
The degree or the measure of effects that have been handed out onto us?
Yes. Earlier you said, I don't have a per se argument. It's not that any effects, but I don't know what the limits are. But I just know these are too high.
I'm pretty sure those are too high. And
so
and
that's my question.
All right.
Is 15, so in your view, 15, because you've made the argument that this disparity is kind of unaccounted for. So I was trying to figure out and relate it back to your takings argument and say, well, is the 15 hours and the 40 decibel, I want to say those are the limits for the Prairie Winds project, is that a taking?
The effects that have been handed out in this case do comprise a taking. First of all, the expert witness, Hessler, said the ideal is 40 dBA, and that's what I like to adhere to.
Is that still a taking at 40? That's my question.
I don't know. I've never been to a wind farm at 40 dBA. I don't have an expert that contradict him, but I do know that in this case, we're all going to get it about 43 dBA, and that the distinction between 40 and 43 is not a trifling matter. It's a significant difference. It's a doubling of the sound pressure level from 40 to 40.
That I understand, but is that problematic for your takings claim ultimately? If we're unable to determine what constitutes a taking and what doesn't?
Well, what I understood Your Honor to be saying, alluding to initially, was a fleeting sound or a passing shadow flicker of some sort on some distant property corner. Getting it on your house for any substantial period of time, minutes or hours, is an entirely different matter, and I think it then becomes a collision with property rights.
Mr. Swanson, in my reading of the record, I understood that part of the discrepancy between the two standards was the two different zoning jurisdictions had different standards. Am I misreading the record?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not entirely sure that, Your Honor, because I only challenged the zoning issue in Dual County.
Well, who would properly set the decibels and the shadow flicker hour? The local zoning board?
I don't think they have
the PUC.
Because they don't have the authority to do it either, Your Honor, as I've argued in number 29352. When an applicant comes to the zoning board, no zoning board that I know of, having hadn't handled a few zoning matters in my lifetime, is able to reach over to the neighbor and say, we're going to borrow your land for purposes of disposal of effects. It's not going to kill you. It might annoy you. But we're going to do it. They don't have that discretion. That's why I've challenged it in 29352, that the zoning power is not so flexible that they can make it as a matter of course to annoy you to the point where they say right at your house, this is what you're going to receive. I don't know how that power exists.
Well, the zonings, even with CAFOs, they can all set up different standards, and some counties are more amenable. They have more relaxed rules on concentrated animal feeding, and some are more restrictive. And can't they do the same thing with shadow flicker and noise?
I understand, but they do not quantify the amount of CAFO odors which an occupant of that house must receive or register at his house before he could challenge it as a nuisance. There is no odor quantification anywhere that I know of under zoning ordinances in the state of South Dakota. If you're going to build a CAFO and run it poorly, negligently, you're going to remain, you and your investment, subject to the confines of the nuisance law.
My more specific question is that a decision when we're talking about the noise or shadow flicker, is that the PUC's wheelhouse or is that the local zoning board that should be making those decisions?
Well, that's a good question because the PUC hasn't adopted any rules. They make up the rules as they come along by listening to experts. But they do definitely tend to follow the zoning board as to what their standards are for noise or shadow flicker. Now, they do this in the name, supposedly, of health and safety.
And they did that here.
But in effect, it's health and safety regulations that become then an easement. Now, can I talk just a little bit about the emperor has no clothes argument that I would wish to make, and that is the health and safety issues based on shadow flicker. They've all, as of 2017, there was a revolution of some kind that I haven't decided where it all started or who promoted it, but we have a new zoning ordinance in Dual County, and I think we also had it in the other two counties that involved this wind farm, and they settled on this 45 dBA and 30 hours of shadow flicker as being what the zoning board or the board adjustment can inflict on neighbors who had sought no zoning relief whatsoever. That became the standard practice. 2017, the PUC starts hearing large wind farm cases more than 100 megawatts.
Your time has expired. You have a concluding statement, very short.
They decide they're going to follow the same pattern. But when you look at the underpinnings of that 30 shadow flicker rule imported from Germany, first published in 2002, they're only applying one-third of the rule without any formal adoption of it. Thank you.
Council.
Thank you.